Shows like Lucifer and Preacher have completely changed the way American television engages with the divine. And today's script, Charon, which follows an ancient Greek mythological god, exists in that exact same tradition. So, stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Yes. Mm. Little Tupac, little throwback. This is a California, Los Angeles. This is, oh, is this Biggie? This is Tupac.
No, that's Tupac.
I panicked. Roxy made a face.
You just
like
got so white right now.
I'm still laughing about Charon.
Charon.
Is this Eminem?
I'm not laughing about that. You did panic, though.
I did panic. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unproduced Table Read here on the Popcorn Talk Network. When I'm not panicking, my name is Jeff. Welcome to the show. If this is your first time being here, this is a show where we read Hollywood's hottest unproduced pilots and features. And today we're reading a very interesting kind of hour-long dramedy about an Uber driver who's actually masked as the ancient Greek god of Charon himself. If you don't know that Greek god, that's okay. He's sort of, I'd say, like more of like a hipster kind of in terms of Mount Olympus. But our writer, Brian Gallagher, was particularly interested in him and his journey. So, Brian, thank you for being here, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
We're very excited. We'll get to you in a minute. But before we do that, I'd love to introduce my cast. Tim, let's start with you.
What's up, guys? Welcome. I am Timothy Michael. Today I will be playing Chet, Russ, Maria, and a few others.
Hi, everybody. I'm Andrew Guy, and today I will be reading for Charon.
Hey, guys. I'm Roxy Strayer, and I'll be reading for Ava and Homeless Man Number 3.
David, let's start at you.
Hey, guys. My name is David Johnson. I'll be reading for Ricky James, Homeless Man Number 2, and a few others.
Yes. And Carolina, welcome.
Hey, guys. I'm Carolina Vanetti, and today I'm reading for Clara, Persephone, Becky, with the good hair.
Yes.
Yeah.
And young woman.
Wonderful. Well, Carolina, thank you for being here. This is your first time on UTR, but we're very excited.
Yes, I'm so excited. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Brian, we're so excited to have you. Guys, you. Brian is a pretty well-known entertainment journalist. You wrote for MovieWeb, TVWeb, and most recently IGN. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
For those of you guys,
read all those things.
Yeah, I know. And for those of you guys who have seen the new Mission Impossible, he just wrote a great breakdown on IGN for that. Oh, nice. So,
did you like it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Incredible.
Yeah, yes.
Amazing. Cool.
Also incredible is this script that you brought in today for us to read, Charon. What I'd like to say is, before we dive in,
just throw it in as many times as you can to make sure.
I know.
For those of you guys who don't know, who are listening to the podcast, Charon is spelled C-H-A-R-O-N, and you will see the spelling versus the pronunciation is a recurring joke in the script. Brian, for our audience and our actors, I'd love for you to give us like a 20 to 30 second pitch kind of into the world we'll be entering before we dive in.
Sure. I've always been fascinated with just Charon himself and just his kind of journey, just because no one really knows anything about it. So I always thought it'd be interesting to see him in a kind of a present day environment like this. And mm-hmm. what better job for him to have than be a Lyft driver.
Yes.
And so he's a Lyft driver, and he finds someone that actually knows who he is. The first person in LA that he's ever met that actually knows who he is and what he's done. So they form a bond, and some crazy stuff happens.
Very cool. And for our audience listening, why would you feel that Charon is particularly well suited for Uber and Lyft?
Well, because his job in the underworld was ferrying souls across River Styx when you died.
So clever.
Same dough.
Yeah. Roxy
so
as well.
He was like the OG Lyft driver. He started a trend.
Exactly. Well, that's perfect. I think that's enough for our audience and our actors, and I'm super excited. One more time, guys. This is Charon.
He says it so effortlessly. We should all try that one.
I'm just so effortful in the way I say it.
In a good way.
In a good way. All right, guys, here we go. Act 1. Exterior downtown Los Angeles alley night. Super 2 years ago. A number of homeless men of varying ages use anything they can to shelter themselves from the elements. Suddenly, a grumbling, bulky man, Charon, 50s, stumbles into the alley. Some of the homeless men take notice, trying to get his attention. He stumbles past them, grabbing a small liquor bottle from his coat and taking a drink.
Do you have any change?
No way. Fuck off.
A third homeless man is about to say something, but just as Charon walks past, he starts coughing violently, causing Charon to stop. He glances down at this haggard man just as he coughs out a fairly large silver coin out of his mouth. Charon's eyes widen as he quickly bends down to snatch the coin, staring at it intently before focusing on the man holding up the coin.
Who are you? Why do you have this oval?
The homeless man has also had a sudden change in demeanor, quickly looks around at his surroundings, and is incredibly dazed and confused.
Where am I?
What?
Where is this place? How did I get here?
I don't know how you got here, but you're in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles?
How did you get this coin?
Charon holds up the silver obol.
What is that?
You spat this out of your mouth like a minute ago.
I don't remember that. I don't remember
anything.
Terrified, the homeless man lies on the ground, unaware of anything else he should be doing. Karan stands up and looks at the ornate silver coin before walking away. Exterior house morning, present day. Title, present day. A beat goes by before Karan walks out of his front door on the small cement path to the driveway of his modest Los Angeles house. A tall, haggard man who cuts an imposing figure is wearing a t-shirt and jeans, slipping his sunglasses on. Karan unlocks his mid-sized sedan with the keychain remote before opening the door and getting in. A beat later, he starts up the car and pulls out of the driveway. Exterior, city street, minutes later. Karan pulls up to a stoplight in the right turn lane, seemingly waiting for an opening, when a frail 20-something male named Chet approaches the vehicle, glancing at the pink lift mustache on the dashboard.
Hey! Are you Charon?
It's pronounced Charon, but yeah.
Cool.
Chet gets in the car while Karan pulls out his cell phone, snapping it in place on the dash mount. He pulls up the Lyft app and turns to Chet.
Where to?
The Grove.
Karan nods as the light turns green and he speeds away. Interior, Karan's car, minutes later. Karan pulls up and stops at a red light, stoic, not saying a word. Chet meekly offers a glance towards Karan, but he doesn't react or say anything. Suddenly, Karan reaches to adjust the rearview mirror and Chet jumps slightly, trying to compose himself, as the light turns green and Karan takes off. Exterior, the Grove, minutes later. Karan's car comes to the side entrance near the parking garage, pulling over to the curb. The door opens as Chet swiftly gets out of the car before looking back towards Karan.
Thank you.
Chet's plastic smile quickly contorts into a look of artificial disgust as he walks away from the car. Chet quickly pulls out his cell phone and brings up his Twitter app. Insert Chet's phone as we see him tweet being typed out on the screen. OMG, Lyft driver today was scary AF, followed by a normal, read ridiculous amount of emojis. Interior, Karan's car later. Karan pulls up to another street corner where a young early 20s woman named Becky approaches the car.
Are you Charon?
Yeah, Charon, actually, but...
Becky shrugs and gets out of the car, producing a friendly smile for her driver.
Paramount lot, please.
Karan nods, puts the car in drive, and merges seamlessly back into traffic. Interior car minutes later. Karan is driving through Hollywood, not saying a word to Becky, when he suddenly reaches for his water bottle in the center console, which makes her jump and gasp a bit. Karan takes a pull from the water bottle and puts it back in the center console.
Would you like some water?
No, thank you.
I have some fresh bottles in the glove.
He starts to reach for the glove compartment.
Quite all right, thank you.
Okay.
Exterior Paramount lot several minutes later. His car pulls into a parking area after passing through a security kiosk, stopping the car near a sidewalk. Becky quickly gets out of the car, offering her driver another fake smile.
Here's fine. Thank you so much.
Becky starts walking to her destination on the lot as Karan's car pulls away. Becky lets out a big sigh of relief as if she just survived a massively traumatic incident. She pulls out her cell phone, opening the Twitter app. Insert. On her phone, we see her tweet being typed. Whoa. He didn't, like, do anything, but Lyft driver just creeped me out. Like, a lot. Becky sends out the tweet, walking through the Paramount lot, still holding onto her phone, when a beat later, it buzzes. She turns it over to see a tweet from her friend Chet. Insert Chet's tweet. Was he, like, huge, with long hair and sunglasses and a weird name, and didn't say anything and was, like, creepy AF?
O-M-G.
Becky starts tweeting up a storm in response to Chet while walking through the Paramount lot. Interior, Karan's car, late afternoon. Karan pulls into a driveway of a small apartment complex and waits for his next rider. A few beats go by when a well-built 20-something dude named Ricky comes out bounding of the apartment towards the car. He doesn't even say anything before getting in, just opens the door and sits down.
Hey, what's up?
hey, man. Where to?
Red Lion, man.
Karan cracks a little smile.
The happy hour, huh?
You know it.
Say no more.
Karan pulls out of the apartment driveway and heads towards Ricky's destination. Interior, Karan's car, minutes later. Karan continues driving along in silence like he usually does while Ricky scrolls through content on his phone.
So, is this place good for happy hour? I don't, like, usually make it out to Silver Lake.
Oh, yeah, man, it's great. You should really check it out sometime.
Cool. I think I will.
Nice.
Karan and Ricky briefly nod at each other as the ride continues. Exterior Red Lion Tavern minutes later, Karan pulls into the parking lot, slowing down in front of the main entrance.
Okay, here you go.
All right, thanks, man.
Ricky reaches out to shake Karan's hand with a smile, and Karan gives him a sturdy handshake, but as Ricky starts opening his door...
I'm pretty much done for the day, and I could use a drink. You mind if I tag along?
A blank look of awkward confusion washes over Ricky's face.
Oh, I've got a group of friends waiting inside.
You know, it's cool. It's cool. Just thought since I'm here. But, you know, it's cool.
Okay.
Have a great night, man.
Karan gives Ricky a nod as he heads inside while Karan pulls out of the parking lot. Exterior downtown LA alley, night. Karan, now on foot, turns a corner and goes down a dark, seedy alley by himself. He reaches in his pocket and pulls out a handful of change. Karan approaches a row of homeless men, all sitting on the ground. Without looking at any of them, he drops a coin in front of each man, but when he suddenly walks past one homeless man in particular, he starts coughing violently. Karan stops immediately and turns to this man, who inexplicably coughs out a large silver coin, which clangs around on the ground. The homeless man and Karan both lock eyes for a split second.
Oh my god. Where am I?
Los Angeles. Do you remember how you got this coin?
What? Los Angeles? Who am I?
Terrified, the homeless man gets up and takes off running with seemingly unnatural speed, leaving the silver coin, which comes to rest on the ground. Karan bends down to pick it up, and which catches the attention of the other homeless men.
Could have that big coin.
Not on your life, old timer.
Karan puts the large silver coin in his pocket while dropping the rest of his change for these bums to fight over. Interior Casey's Irish Pub, minutes later, Karan sits by himself finishing his pint of beer as the bartender James heads over.
Hey, ready for another?
Sure.
James takes Karan's empty pint and pours another beer. He brings it back to Karan, who puts a 20 on the bar.
Thanks.
James turns to the register behind him and puts down Karan's change. Karan separates two singles and pushes it out for James' tip.
And thank you.
Karan nods and is almost about to take a sip of his beer when...
Oh my god, Ava?
Karan turns to where James is looking, seeing Ava Garces, 28, a tall drink of a Latina badassness, wearing her marine fatigues, who just lights up after having seen James. James runs out from behind the bar and gives her a big hug. Karan just shrugs and goes back to his beer.
It's so good to see you, James.
I can't believe you're back. How long was your deployment this time?
7 long-ass months, so glad to be home.
James hugs her again before heading back behind the bar.
Grab a seat. What'll it be?
Ava sits down a few seats from Karan.
Del Patron.
Sure thing.
Ava takes a look around the bar before turning back to James.
Hey, have you seen Russ?
Not tonight, no. He came through the other day, though. What, you ain't tell him you're home yet?
Nah, I want to surprise him.
A customer from the other end of the bar flags James down.
Excuse me.
Karan takes another drink from his beer, then spots someone coming from the entrance from the corner of his eye. He looks over when he sees a frantic young man texting up a storm when...
Oh my god, Russ?
Russ, 31, white, looks up from texting, fake shocked to see his girlfriend Ava.
Ava? Well, I can't believe it.
Russ runs over as they both embrace and kiss while James comes back with Ava's drink.
Oh, I found Russ, Ava. He's right there.
Without breaking from her kiss, Ava juts out her hand, giving James the finger before sliding her hand over Russ's neck.
Russ, PBR for you.
Russ sticks out his hand and gives James a thumbs up sign before sliding his hand over to Ava's ass. James shakes his head and goes over to pour Russ's beer. After a few beats, James and Ava release from their embrace and head toward the bar, just as James comes back with Russ's beer. They both sit down and take a few brief drinks before going back to kissing for a few more beats before Russ releases.
I can't believe you're home, baby. Why didn't you tell me you were coming back today?
Yeah, well, I wanted to surprise you.
Oh, you know, I hate surprises, Ava.
Exactly.
Ava grins deviously while Russ just shakes his head and takes another drink.
Oh, you're killing me here.
Oh, you know I'll make it up to you tonight, so just humor me for a bit.
What next? A cutesy couples pick?
Ava's eyes twinkle devilishly while Russ rolls his eyes.
That's not a damn bad idea. Excuse me, sir.
Karan puts his beard on and turns towards Ava and Russ.
Yes?
Hi, I was wondering if you could take a photo of me and my boyfriend here.
Yeah, sure.
Ava smiles, extending her cell phone towards Karan, who gets up and takes it from her, framing the shot. After Russ finally manages a decent smile, Karan takes the pic.
Thank you so much.
Don't mention it. Thank you for your service.
Thank you for saying so. I'm Ava, and this is my boyfriend, Russ.
Nice to meet you. I'm Karan.
Russ squints a bit, not recognizing the name at all, while Ava lights up as Karan hands the phone back to Ava.
You don't say.
What do you mean?
Karan, like... the boatman?
Karan's eyes widen, completely taken aback.
Huh? You know this dude, baby?
Ava starts laughing while Karan cracks a slight smile, making Russ even more confused.
No, not him, but his name. Karan was the guy in Greek mythology who ferried souls across the river Styx. Never heard anyone actually named after him, though.
Actually, yeah, that's absolutely right.
Ava narrows her eyes, seeing if she can have a bit of fun with him.
You seem surprised. What? You don't think Latinas from the hood know their mythology?
No, not necessarily. It's just that Casey's has never struck me as a hangout for mythological scholars, that's all.
Ava cracks up laughing while Russ looks even more confused, drinking the rest of his beer empty. He gets Ava's attention and nods toward the door. Ava nods back, downing the rest of her drink.
Well, we have to get going, but thanks again for taking the picture.
Anytime.
Kieran, Ava, and Russ all exchange pleasant nods as Ava and Russ quickly head out of the bar to make up for lost time as James returns.
Another?
Why not? It's Tuesday.
James chuckles and shakes his head, grabbing Caron's empty beer glass from the bar. Exterior, Boyle Heights House next afternoon. All is quiet in this neighborhood when suddenly the front door springs open and the disheveled and scantily clad young woman, early 20s, runs out of the house.
You're crazy! You're fucking crazy!
Suddenly, a vase comes flying out of the house as the young woman ducks it and takes off running. A beat later, a scorned Ava is walking out of the house, followed by Russ, wearing only boxers, rushing to catch up with her.
Ava, wait!
Russ catches up to her and grabs her by the shoulder, which was not the right play. Ava immediately grabs his hand and spins him around, twisting his arm behind his back when she clamps down on a painful pressure point on his hand between his thumb and forefinger. This sends Russ to his knees in the middle of the front yard, screaming in agony. Suddenly, Caron's car pulls into the driveway. He rolls down the window, seeing Ava inflicting tons of pain on her now ex-boyfriend.
Holy shit.
Whoa, boatman, is that you?
End of act one. Act two. Exterior Boyle Heights house continuous. While never releasing her painful grip on Russ, Ava looks quite surprised.
What the fuck are you doing here?
In complete agony, Russ slowly looks up, seeing Kieran.
You the guy who took our picture last
night?
Shut
the fuck up.
Kieran holds up his cell phone, which has the Lyft app on display.
Someone named Clara requested a Lyft from here.
Jesus, you're a Lyft driver?
Not much need for a boatman in this town, so what's good?
Clara's my bitch sister who took off running, and Russ here was just about to apologize for being a shitty boyfriend, weren't you, Russ?
Ava clamps on the pressure point while cranking his arm back.
Fuck! Oh, I didn't mean shit. It just... You were over in the sandbox.
And it just happened, yeah?
Yeah! I mean,
Ava releases her grip from her cheating boyfriend, but then delivers a swift knee to the head, knocking him out cold.
Oh, Jesus.
Ava calmly moves towards Kieran, going around his car to get in the passenger side door.
Anyway, since Clara's long gone and you're here, I'll take her ride. It still charges her card, right?
Ava offers a devious smile, which Kieran returns, smiling for the first time, it seems, in ages, as he shakes his head.
Works for me. So, where to?
Where we met last night. I need a drink.
Kieran nods as he starts up the car and pulls out of the driveway, while Russ remains unconscious on the front lawn. A few neighbors start to come out of their homes as Kieran heads towards Casey's. Interior, Kieran's car, minutes later. The car is silent as Kieran heads towards downtown when Ava finally breaks the ice.
Aren't you the slightest bit curious about why all shit happened back there?
It's not too hard to figure out.
Suppose not, but don't you want to know the twist?
Oh, why not?
I take it you gathered I'm a Marine from last night, yeah?
Yeah.
So I just got back from my deployment last night and went right to see him. We go back to our place, make up for lost time and all that, and today I go see my family. Everyone's there, except my sister, Clara.
Insert quick flashback of the woman, Clara, running out of Russ's house minutes ago.
Oh, shit.
Kieran glances at her, impressed and remorseful all at once.
Yeah, they have always been horrible liars, so it didn't take me long to get it out of them, and I went down there to confront them, and she ran. She's lucky she ran, too.
That's quite a twist.
Ava slumps into the passenger seat, shaking her head.
Yeah, it is, but it's done. So let's talk about some other shit.
Sure.
A beat or two goes by, neither knowing what to say, when...
Oh, kind of funny how you're a Lyft driver with your name. Kind of the same job, really.
Kinda, yeah. I'm honestly surprised you even know the name at all. Got a nephew or something who likes Percy Jackson?
Ava lets out a hearty laugh, glancing at this stoic and bizarre Lyft driver.
No, not Percy Jackson. I kind of got into it while I was in juvie.
Sounds like a long story.
It is.
Kieran nods as Ava offers a faint smile, sighing, shaking her head while looking out the window. Exterior, Casey's Irish Pub later. Kieran pulls his car up to Casey's entrance and parks. Ava smiles and nods at Kieran.
Thanks, boatman, for listening to all my shit.
Kieran smiles and nods, and as Ava starts to get out of the car...
If you need someone to talk to or anything, I could use a drink, too.
Kieran apprehensively glances at Ava, seeing how she reacts... Coyly, she smiles, leaning back in the passenger seat.
Oh, really, big boy?
I didn't mean it like
Ava
that.
Ava drops the act and starts laughing while Kieran rolls his eyes.
I'm just fucking with you.
Ava slowly starts to remember why she came here in the first place, and her mood turns more somber.
I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to overstep.
Look,
I just...
I,
I really do appreciate it. And I know you didn't mean anything by it. I figured you'd have to be pretty crazy to try something after what you saw today.
I'm plenty crazy. Just not that crazy.
Ava chuckles, which causes Charon to produce a meek smile, but she starts to become overrun by her emotions.
Thanks for the offer, but I just really need to be alone right now.
Yeah, I understand. Take care, Ava.
She smiles while opening the door.
You too, boatman.
She gets out of the car and closes the door, swiftly heading toward the Casey's entrance. Charon lets out a big sigh as she disappears into the bar as he starts up the car and takes off. Interior, Casey's Irish Pub an hour later. The bartender, James, sets a beer and shot down in front of Ava.
Thanks, James.
James nods, but has a concerned look on his face.
No problem. So where's Russ?
Ava downs her shot and takes a drink from her beer before responding.
Not sure, actually. I was hanging out with his family all day. Know what's nuts, though?
What's that?
I go to get a lift back, and guess who my lift driver is? The big dude from last night.
Yeah, Charon. He's in here all the time. That is kind of nuts that he was your lift guy, though. Thankfully, he only comes in here after his shifts.
Ava shakes her head, smiling.
Good to know.
She takes a few drinks as a few customers walk in behind her.
Well, just holler if you need another one.
Thanks, James.
James heads back toward the other end of the bar, of the sparsely populated bar, toward the new customers. Ava takes another sip of beer when...
Ava...
Ava's eyes widened in rage, snapping her head around. She sees the duplicitous sister, Clara.
You fucking bitch.
Without hesitation, Ava lunges at her sister, taking her to the ground. A split second later, James sees what's happening, with Ava getting her hands around Clara's throat. He springs into action, ducking under a partition in the bar, running over and grabbing Ava, while another bouncer grabs Clara as they're both separated from each other.
I can't fucking believe you'd fuck my man while I was gone.
Clara breaks down in tears, bawling, slumping to the ground as the bouncer just awkwardly kind of lets her go. Clara wipes away the tears and looks at her sister still on her knees.
I came here to apologize.
Bullshit!
Clara calmly gets to her feet, followed closely by the bouncer. She continues to wipe the tears away from her face while putting the errant hair back from her face.
No, I know. I fucked up. I know I did. It's just, you know, a few months ago he called and he said he was lonely and he wanted to hang out and everything. And I didn't think anything would...
Come on.
I swear to God, Ava, he came on to me. I know that's no excuse, but I've been lonely too.
Clara starts full on bawling again, falling to her knees again. And as the bouncer just watches her and shrugs at James, he shrugs back, still restraining Ava.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, please forgive me, Ava. Please. I'm so sorry, Ava. I'm begging you.
Ava's stone-cold demeanor cracks, seeing her sister literally begging for forgiveness. James sees the emotion flooding through Ava's face and calmly lets her go, and she gives him a nod.
Get up.
Clara slowly gets to her feet, wiping tears away, still unsure if Ava's going to punch her or embrace her.
Please, do you
Please, before she can get out of the word forgive, Ava embraces her sister. Clara starts sobbing again while Ava starts to tear up a little as well.
I forgive you.
The waterworks continue as both James and the bouncer let out respective sighs and head back to their posts, with James behind the bar and the bouncer manning the door. As the bouncer walks back, though, he notices something peculiar. Clara is literally texting behind Ava's back.
Thank you so much, Ava. I love you so much.
I love you too, but... Man, that was pretty fucked up.
They both laugh and release from their hug as Clara stealthily slides her phone back in her pocket.
Yeah, it was. I can't believe you threw a vase at me.
Ava chuckles.
You're just lucky I can't throw as well as I can shoot.
Guess so.
Ava Garces?
Ava squints and turns around, not realizing that Clara is slowly backing away from her. Ava turns to see two cops standing in front of her. She doesn't even have time to answer them, frozen in a bit of rage. In a fit of rage, her eyes widening. She turns back around to face Clara, who's smiling deviously, waving at Ava.
Miss Garza says you're going to have to come with us.
Ava keeps staring at her sister, which causes Clara's maniacal grin to crack a bit.
On what charge?
Assault and battery. Your ex-boyfriend, Russ, pressed formal charges after an altercation that took place this afternoon.
Ava doesn't answer, staring a figurative hole through their sister. Through her sister, Clara just smiles devilishly.
Sorry, sis.
Ava doesn't answer. Ava doesn't hesitate. Charging at her sister once again, but this time, Clara plays it up much differently for the cops.
Oh my God, help me! She's crazy! She's gonna kill me!
The cops rush to pull Ava off of Clara. As they drag Ava away, she violently points at her sister.
I'm not fucking done with you yet.
He's my man now, bitch!
As she's being dragged away, Ava just shakes her head and tries to avert a complete breakdown as James and the rest of the bar patrons look on. End of Act 2. Act 3. Exterior police station next morning. Ava walks down the steps of the police station, downtrodden, looking only at the ground in front of her.
Need a lift?
Ava looks down and sees Karan, leaning against his car. She smiles almost instinctively before curiosity gets the better of her.
Okay, you don't expect me to believe this is a coincidence, do you? That you just happen to be here?
No, of course not. I bailed you out.
Ava can't seem to put the right words together, flabbergasted.
You didn't have to...
I went to Casey's last night. James told me you needed some help. He didn't think that you had a place to stay, and now that I see
a sudden
this...
realization dawns on Ava. That, she's now homeless. Still, she tries to spin it.
Oh, it's cool. I can probably stay with my folks.
James seemed to make it clear that wasn't an option, for whatever reason.
Seething, she marches up to Charon.
Well, it seems James has a big fucking mouth now, doesn't it?
I have a tiny little house, not too far from here. It's not much, but it has a spare bedroom, and if you want it, until you get back on your feet, it's yours.
Why are you doing this?
Like, if I would have stopped you yesterday, Russ wouldn't have gotten knocked out and wouldn't have pressed charges.
I suppose I...
Besides, I have no one to talk to about mythology, so a bunch of heathens in this town, you know?
Ava can't help but laugh, shaking her head. Charon smiles and opens up the passenger side door of the car like a fancy chauffeur.
So, what do you say? Your chariot awaits?
Ava laughs, shaking her head as she walks toward the car. Interior, exterior, Charon's car, minutes later. Charon drives in silence as Ava just looks out the window. He brings the car to a stop at a light while Ava just shakes her head, which Charon notices.
Is something wrong?
Everything we've talked about in the last few days, mythology, juvie, my family problems... We're all because of that.
Ava points across the street as Charon glances over, seeing a group of young Latina gangsters, cholas. The light turns green as Charon drives past the sign, glancing at Ava.
I was 15 years old. I joined a gang.
And I guess your family wasn't too thrilled.
My parents both hated me for it, said I was a disgrace to the family, but they were too busy fighting with each other, so there's that.
I'm sorry.
Ava nods, indifferent.
It was a lifetime ago.
Charon nods back, continuing the drive. Interior, Charon's house later. The door to Charon's modest abode opens as he walks in, holding the front door open for Ava, who's carrying a backpack.
Here we are.
Suddenly, we hear a dog bark as Charon closes the door.
That's Rascal. He's big, but he's harmless.
Charon kneels down as Rascal, a large Rottweiler, runs up to his owner, licking his face.
Kind of like his owner, eh?
Charon looks up with a smirk as Ava has a big shit-eating grin on her face.
Yeah, kinda.
Charon grabs the two metal dog bowls and takes them into the modest kitchen.
So, grand tour, I guess. Kitchen.
Nice.
Charon fills up one dog bowl with water from the tap, then pulls a large bag of dog food from under the sink, topping off Rascal's bowl. Charon puts the dog food bag back under the sink, then puts the bowls back in their place. Charon looks at Ava and takes a few steps, leading her into the living room, featuring a mid-size HD TV and a couch directly across from it.
And next we have the living room.
Quite elegant.
Why, thank you.
He leads her into a hallway.
Bathroom's here on the right. There's clean towels on the rack if you want to clean up or, you know, whatever.
Okay, great.
Charon leads Ava past the bathroom towards her room.
And your room is here, and I'm at the end of the hall.
Charon opens the door, revealing a modest room with a small bed, closet, and small desk. She smiles and turns back to Charon.
I really do appreciate this, Charon.
It's the least I could do.
Bailing me out was the least you could do. This is something much more, so thanks again, sincerely.
She offers him a warm smile.
You're very welcome. Well, listen, I'm going to head out and work for a few hours, but I'll bring back some dinner if you're hungry.
Okay.
Great.
It's good.
Great. I'll be back in a few hours.
Charon nods and heads back out the door. Ava watches him leave when she looks down and sees Rascal standing at her feet. She smiles, holding out her hand for the dog to sniff it, which he does before starting to lick her hand. She crouches down to pet the dog, who starts panting with delight.
Yeah, you're a big softy, aren't you? Just like your dad, right?
Rascal comes in closer and starts licking her face, causing her to start laughing. Interior, Charon's kitchen, hours later. Both Charon and Ava sit around a modest table, enjoying dinner in authentic Mexican food and beer.
Thanks again for dinner.
Not a problem. It feels good to actually have someone for once.
You help people. I assume most of your passengers would get DWIs without you.
That's probably true. But it's not the same.
I suppose not.
Ava goes back to her dinner while Charon ponders something, appearing deep in thought.
Look, I hate to bring it up because it seemed like it was a sore subject, but I'm kind of fascinated how the gang life led to an interest in mythology.
Ava nods and shrugs, taking a sip of her beer.
It's definitely not your typical story.
Those are usually the best.
When I got to juvie, I was so done with all the gang shit, so I basically kept to myself in the library. I was never an honor student or anything like that, but mythology was the one thing that really interested me, so I just read whatever I could.
I see. If you don't mind me asking, what happened that landed you in juvie?
Oh,
It's look, if it's a story you don't really want to tell, it's fine. I understand.
Ava sighs, taking a drink from her beer.
No, it's fine. So, like I was saying before, when I was 15, I joined a gang.
Exterior street, night flashback. A 15-year-old Ava is walking with a few of her fellow gangsters, cholas, sporting black tank tops and khakis.
It was stupid. I was just pissed off about everything. Mom leaving, school, all sorts of shit. So it made sense then.
One of the other girls sees something and gets young Ava's attention as they keep walking.
One night we see these bloodettes and they didn't see us or anything.
Just a few feet away, a group of young girls, all wearing some form of red clothing, all walk out of the corner store, but all their backs are turned towards Ava.
And I don't know what happened, man. And something just snapped when I saw all of them.
Ava picks up her pace, walking faster than the other cholas, sticking a hand in her khaki pockets as she reaches the group of bloodlets. Ava pulls her hand out of her pocket, raising a fist with brass knuckles, just as one of the other girls with the bright red headband ties around her head, turning around. Ava slams her brass-knuckled fist into her face.
I didn't even know her. Found out later her name was Maria. Must have been one of the new girls or something, but it didn't matter. I was just so fucking mad.
Ava knocks the girl down to the ground, stomping on her face. The rest of the cholas fight the other girls around them until a police siren permeates the area. All of the girls from both sets scatter, except Ava, who just keeps stomping away, a fiery rage built inside her. A few beats go by until the police car arrives and multiple officers finally subdue her.
So I snapped, and I beat her so bad she slipped into a coma.
End flashback. Interior Charon's kitchen continuous. Ava's lost in her own moroseness, shaking her head, never looking up. Charon is transfixed with this story, snapping out of it momentarily to take a drink.
She was in a coma for 4 years, and I guess her family thought she was never waking up, so they pulled the plug.
Wow.
So yeah, I spent 3 years in juvie lockup. I was done with the gang shit. I wanted as far away from that as I could possibly be. And then it turns out the furthest I could be from all that was in the library.
Was it kind of like an escape for you?
I mean, yeah, we don't have chicks with snakes for hair and three-headed dogs in the hood. So yeah, I really started getting into it.
So how'd you end up in the Marines then?
She shrugs, finally glancing at Charon.
I got my GED in juvie, but shit, it's not like colleges were banging down my door. There aren't a whole lot of options for anyone in my situation, so I went into the Marines.
Do you think the Marines is the right choice?
She sighs and slams the rest of her beer.
I mean, I did turn my life around, and I'm grateful for that, but it sure as hell was no picnic.
How long were you overseas for?
Did 3 tours total so far. This last one was 7 months.
Did you lose a lot of people over there?
Like I said, no picnic.
Charon smirks, standing up from the table, opening one of the cupboards, pulling out a bottle of tequila with one hand and 2 shot glasses with the other. He pours 2 shots and brings them back to the kitchen table. He grabs his shot glass and raises it to Ava.
To the fallen ones, wherever they may be.
She nods, mildly touched, but tries not to let her emotions show.
To the fallen ones.
They clink shot glasses and slam them quickly. She follows that up with a big swig of her beer, and she leans back in her chair.
So, what's your story?
My story?
Yeah, I mean, I like mythology and all that shit, but man, I didn't get named after someone. Damn, your folks must have loved that shit.
Ava laughs a hearty laugh while Charon just smiles, quickly downing his shot before taking a big pull of his beer.
Yeah, something like that.
Man, you said it yourself. I had to know my shit just to know who you were. But man, your folks must have been freaks for all that.
She takes another drink while Charon seems lost in thought again.
I'll tell you what. I want to show you something.
He stands up and grabs his keys from the counter.
A field trip?
Yeah, something like that.
Ava nods and stands up, drinking the rest of her beer. Interior, exterior, Charon's car, minutes later. Charon drives through the streets of downtown L.A. as Ava keeps trying to guess their destination.
I'm telling you, man, this is my town. I grew up here, and I know every nook and cranny, so you better just tell me where you're taking me.
But it will ruin the surprise. Besides, you'll never guess anyway.
That's so, Mr. Sticks.
It is.
Charon comes to a stop sign, making a right-hand turn. Ava's navigational-slash-investigative gears are turning, still trying to decipher their destination.
Where are you from, anyway?
Charon pauses, unsure of what to tell her at this point.
That's where I'm taking you, actually.
Really? And this place you're from is a place I'll never guess. A place in my hometown.
Look, we're almost there.
Ava turns her attention back to the road as she sees they're about to approach the 6th Street Bridge, which goes over the L.A. River. Instead of going over the bridge, Charon turns off a side street, running parallel with the bridge. Ava, more confused now than ever, turns to Charon.
You can't be from down here. There ain't shit down here.
Not exactly.
Ava glances back at the street, seeing they're literally running out of road, but Charon isn't slowing down.
Okay, this was funny and all, but...
almost there.
He veers directly under the bridge, speeding over a few sets of railroad tracks before heading down a concrete incline that takes them into the LA River, which barely contains any water whatsoever. Ava has no idea what to make of all of this as Charon continues to drive.
What the fuck? The LA River?
I said you wouldn't guess it, didn't I?
Well... yeah, but...
now, driving at top speed, Charon goes under the 7th Street Bridge above.
I mean, you can't be from down here, you just can't.
No, I'm not.
He drives under the multiple lanes of the 10, still picking up speed. Ava starts to freak out a little bit.
You're still not going to tell me anything?
I won't need to in a minute here.
Charon nods at the next overpass, Olympic Boulevard. Ava glances at it for a split second, then turns back to Charon.
Olympic Boulevard, what about it?
Anoix Sosami.
Suddenly, the open space under the overpass becomes a bright red portal, which Charon is driving straight towards.
Oh, my God!
The entire interior of the car becomes enveloped with red light for a second or two when it clears, and suddenly, Charon and Ava are not driving through the LA River anymore. They're on the shores of another river, one with black water flowing freely as Charon slams on the brakes of the bank of this river. Charon says nothing while Ava suddenly snaps her head towards Charon for a beat, confused and bewildered before quickly getting out of the car. Exterior, underworld, continuous. Nothing looks the same in this place. The soil and the sky are both red with the river pitch black. Ava slowly wanders away from the car, trying to process everything, when she hears the murmuring din of the large collective of people. Ava slowly realizes that this noise is coming from the other side of the river, past a foggy haze that swirls over this flowing current. Cautiously, Ava walks closer and closer to the water when suddenly, through the fog, she sees millions of people on the banks of the River Styx. Slowly, it dawns on Ava as she whips her head back towards the car. Charon gets out of the car, slowly walking towards Ava.
You mean you're the real...
Charon.
And yep. This is...
Welcome to the underworld.
End of Act 3. Act 4, interior underworld continuous. Ava frantically wanders around the banks of Styx, trying to process this all and freaking out a bit. Charon walks behind her, keeping his distance, when she suddenly turns to face him.
Why did you take me here? Wait.
Her eyes widen, a terrifying notion dawning on her as Charon slowly approaches her.
Ava just...
Holy shit. I didn't die, did I? Is that why I'm here? For you to ferry my soul or some shit?
No, you're not dead, I swear.
Shit, how can I believe you? You were always portrayed as a greedy prick in the books.
Ava, please.
Ava
Jesus.
Turns to the millions of unburied on the other side of the river.
All these people, they're stuck here for 100 years, right? Because you refuse to take them without your fare.
That's not how it works. It's not just me. It's the underworld, how Hades wants it. Those without proper burial are not allowed.
Ava calms down, still breathing heavily, turning back to Charon.
Okay, so I'm not dead then. What the hell are we doing here then?
That is a very good question, my dear.
Ava furrows her brow, looking past Charon, who just closes his eyes for a second and sighs. A beat or two goes by before Charon turns to face Persephone, 20-something, an ageless, goddess-like quality.
It's been far too long.
Persephone sighs that terrifying sigh of a scorned woman, slowly approaching Charon, who inadvertently backs up slowly.
Been far too long, he says. After 2 fucking years, been far too long is all you have.
Please look, Persephone, I...
No. First, you're going to tell me why you left me for 2 years.
Ava glances at Charon.
I just needed a break.
Bullshit. You've been ferrying Sol for thousands of fucking years.
I was always planning on coming back, but my break was a bit... longer than I planned.
Livid. Persephone comes closer, still dwarfed by Charon, but it's clear that the size is no consequence here.
Okay. Say I even buy that garbage and let it slide for now. Then what, pray tell, are you doing here, now, with her?
Persephone thrusts a finger in Ava's direction, which even causes her to jump slightly.
I met her on Earth, and I wanted to give her some closure.
What? And who the fuck is this, anyway?
Ava points right at Persephone.
Ava, meet Persephone, Persephone, Ava.
Ava's eyes widen. She turns to Charon.
No shit. The real Persephone?
Persephone eyes Ava up curiously.
Mythology scholars are certainly more diverse these days, it seems. You must be either loaded or banging him for him to bring you here.
I'm gonna let that go. But what do you mean, closure?
The girl you beat up, who died... You seem really torn up over it, so I thought maybe...
You bring me to the underworld to meet the girl I killed?
basically.
Ava just looks at Charon, the gravity of this gesture weighing on her when Persephone chimes in.
She still has to pluck the bow, you know.
That's why we're here.
Oh, then don't let me stop you. You know where the forest is.
Coldly, Persephone turns to walk back the other way when Charon catches up to her and whispers in her ear.
Look, I can't tell you why I left. Not here. It has to be on Earth. After.
Persephone stops and turns, getting face to face with Charon. He just nods at her and turns back towards Ava as he leads her to the forest. Persephone just stands there for a beat or two, watching them leave. Exterior underworld forest minutes later. Charon and Ava approach the entrance of the forest.
By the way, what was that thing you said just before we got here?
Anawake Sosami?
Yeah, what does that mean?
It's really corny.
And yet, I still want to know.
Fine. It's Greek for open sesame.
So you immortals are just as corny as us mere mortals, eh?
It certainly seems so.
Charon stops before the forest entrance.
So what now, then?
Did you ever read the Aeneid?
Yeah, ages ago.
Book 6, do you remember the story of Aeneas? He was a living warrior who was guided into the underworld by Sybil so he could visit her late father. Sybil said that anyone who was descending to Earth's hidden world
must gather the golden-haired produce from its tree.
That's right. If you can find and pluck the bough, then you can remain in the underworld. No feat of strength from the strongest person will remove it.
Not even Hercules?
He tried once and wasn't pretty. He was so pissed off that he stole Cerberus, and all because he couldn't pluck the little golden bough. What a prick.
Okay, so what if I can't pluck it?
If you cannot remove it easily, you are not welcome in the underworld. I don't even know where it is, just that it's surrounded by a valley of little light.
Okay.
Ava eyes the forest entrance hesitantly.
Look, if you don't want to,
No, let's go.
Ava forges ahead blindly into the forest with Charon trailing behind her. Exterior forest minutes later, Ava confidently strides through the forest using her cell phone as a makeshift guiding light of sorts. Charon trails behind her.
You know where you're going?
Well, I doubt the underworld forest is on Google Maps, or nah, so not really. My phone is the only source of light, so if I see another, bingo.
Suddenly, a flock of doves flies over their heads. The doves all circle themselves briefly before arranging themselves into a large arrow, pointing northwest of Ava and Charon's current location. Ava starts laughing as both she and Charon smile at each other.
Is that Persephone?
I hope so. If not, that means others know I'm here.
Why does everyone in the underworld hate you?
It's complicated.
Hades caught you banging Persephone, didn't he?
Aghast, a wide-eyed Charon turns to Ava.
What?
Not too hard to figure out.
Ava winks at Charon playfully.
For one, he never caught me, but I left for a completely different reason. I just can't get into it here. Hades has eyes and ears everywhere.
Ava nods, glancing at Charon, seeing him flustered for the first time. Exterior, deeper in the forest minutes later. Ava and Charon continue walking when they notice the arrow formed by the dove starts pointing to an area below them, the aforementioned Valley of Little Light. Ava and Charon look at each other before Ava walks to the edge of the ridge. She looks down and smiles, nodding at Charon to join her. Charon walks up to her and sees what she sees down in the valley, a speck of golden light. Ava smiles and looks at Charon.
Yes, we found it.
Let's go.
Ava and Charon carefully climb down the ridge and make it to the Valley of Little Light with the shiny golden bough staring back at both of them. Suddenly, Ava seems quite nervous, hesitating, even after all they've been through.
What if it doesn't work?
It doesn't work and we go back to L.A., but at least we tried.
Here goes everything.
Ava slowly reaches for the bough, lightly grasping it while closing her eyes. She suddenly yanks on the branch as the bough comes free. Overjoyed, Ava opens her eyes and sees the golden bough in her hand.
Oh my god, yes, thank you so much.
Ava suddenly jumps for joy before giving Charon a big bear hug.
You're welcome, but we should get out of here, though. The longer we're here, the more dangerous it is.
Oh, okay.
Charon and Ava start walking back to the forest entrance, with him setting a brisk pace. Exterior, Styx Riverbanks, several minutes later. Charon and Ava approach the riverbanks area where they entered the portal, although Charon notices Persephone is leaning against their car, smirking.
Get the bow, I see.
Ava holds it up, nodding.
So how do we find her?
I thought we could go see Rhadamanthus.
He won't know. It's not like he keeps records of everyone he's judged. She's not in the Elysian Fields, then?
Given her background, unlikely.
Frustrated, Ava glances around the shore, seeing millions of unburied souls just wandering aimlessly.
Honestly, she's probably somewhere on the other side of the Styx.
They have to be a million on those riverbanks.
Then we better get started.
Ava flips him the golden bow and walks towards the riverbank, where Charon's skiff is ashore. On the other side of Styx, minutes later, Charon guides his skiff ashore, hopping out and pulling it further onto dry land. He then helps Persephone and Ava out of the boat, and they all turn around. The horde of unburied all turn to them, millions of them, Ava now comprehending this daunting task.
There's just no way. This is even worse than a needle in a haystack.
Hey, we already found one, remember?
Charon pulls out the golden bow and hands it to Ava, who smiles.
Well, let's go.
Surprised at Persephone's initiative, Charon and Ava both follow her as she cuts a swath into the crowd. Interior, underworld, unburied, herd, continuous. Persephone cuts a path through the herd as Charon and Ava follow, both looking in all directions for Maria.
I can't believe none of these people were buried right.
I mean, in the old days, the family would bury the deceased with a coin called an obol. They would stick in the deceased's mouth.
Not over the eyes?
In the movies, yes. Not in reality, though. So, when they would get here, upon meeting me, the coin would materialize in their mouth, transferring from their world to ours, which would pay me my toll. Everyone would always spit out this coin in the same way right when they'd approach me.
And no one has spit out a coin yet here?
Not a one.
Puzzled, Persephone cranes her head and shoots Charon a glance. Charon mouths, later, without actually saying the word.
Oh, I've been waiting 10 years for this shit.
Suddenly, Maria bursts out of the crowd and tackles Ava to the ground, strangling her, quite similar to how Ava strangled her sister at the bar.
Maria, please, I'm so, so sorry.
Oh, you're sorry. Now, after killing me a decade ago, well, why didn't you fucking say so?
Maria hauls back and punches Ava in the face before Charon can pull her off as Maria struggles to get free.
Did you see a coin? Did she spit out a coin?
Maria glances back at Charon, angrily confused.
The fuck you talking about, old man?
Look, I'm Charon, the boatman who ferries souls across the River Styx, but when you first meet me, a silver coin called an obol is supposed to materialize in your mouth.
What does that mean?
It can only mean one thing. She wasn't buried properly.
Bullshit. No one in Ahud would have not buried us properly. Okay, that would mean her family didn't bury her either.
She's actually not dead.
What the fuck?
I know this is crazy, but I went through a lot today just to make this right, and I've been living with this for a decade. I quit the life completely, joined the Marines after juvie.
Maria eases up ever so slightly, breathing heavily, still seething, but to a lesser extent.
She's here for closure, Maria.
Oh, yeah, good for her. Okay, get her closure while I'm still stuck down here for another on these banks for another 90 years.
How do you know that?
It's what everyone says. If you're here, you wander these banks for 100 years before you find your true place or something.
It was strictly forbidden for me to bring anyone across who didn't have a proper burial, even if they were buried with regular gold coins from their families, like the old days. That has to be why there's so many more here.
And a lot of people don't even get buried anymore. They get...
Ava's eyes light up as she looks at Charon, who has come to the same conclusion.
Oh, cremated.
Ava and Charon both look to Maria.
Do you think your family might have cremated you instead of buried you in a cemetery?
Probably. Not that I think about it.
Yeah, but cremation doesn't count. The remains need to have due burial place, and most people scatter the ashes or keep them in an urn or whatever.
But if we buried the urn in a cemetery, that should work, yeah?
There's only one way to find out.
End of Act 4. Act 5, interior, Charon's car, night. Charon speeds through a South Los Angeles neighborhood with Ava scouring through content on her phone.
Talk to me. Where am I going?
Coming up here, left side of the street.
Ava finally spots the house just on the left.
There, red mailbox.
Got it.
Charon pulls over to the curb, parking the car, turning off the engine. Ava puts her phone away, looking ragged and jittery.
Wow, I can't believe how nervous I am.
After all we've been through today?
I know, that's why I'm surprised. I always wondered what I'd say to her when I died, like, how would that go?
It's really great what you're doing.
No, it's what we're doing.
Ava smiles at Charon while slugging him playfully on the shoulder.
You sure this'll work?
50-50?
Lie to me, maybe.
Sure, it'll work, Ava.
Ava shakes her head at Charon and gets out of the car. He follows as they slowly approach Maria's childhood home. There are two cars in the driveway, but no lights in the house are on.
We'll probably have better luck going around back.
Charon nods as they walk up the driveway, ducking underneath the windows in case anyone's actually awake. Interior, Maria's home continuous. The doorknob jiggles a bit for a beat or two before it finally opens. Ava comes in first, putting a credit card back in her wallet. Charon follows behind her as they both pull out their cell phones, which they use as makeshift flashlights.
The living room in these houses is usually that way. Almost all the houses around here are the same.
Charon nods, following closely behind Ava as they walk through the kitchen in the back of the house. After a brief scan of the kitchen, they move on to the living room. Interior, living room continuous. Ava leads the way into the living room, slowly sweeping the room with her cell phone light when she suddenly gasps, nearly jumping out of her skin. Kieran turns back to her and sees what Ava sees. A teenage black male sleeping on the couch. He's wearing a wife beater and has an unmistakable red bandana tied around his arm. Ava is frozen, keeping the light on this young blood, when Kieran puts his hand over hers, moving the light away from the youngster. She looks to Kieran and he gives her a reassuring nod. Ava nods back, starting her sweep of the room while Kieran goes to the other side. Ava moves as quietly through the living room as she can when her cell phone light sweeps past a mantle where, lo and behold, is Maria's urn.
Kieran
doesn't turn around, so she grabs the urn and then turns her cell phone light on him. He turns around, shining his light on her, seeing her with the urn cradled in one arm, while giving him a giddy thumbs up with the other hand. Kieran turns his light on the front door. Ava nods and starts slowly walking over towards it. Kieran slowly moves toward the door as well when he steps on something unexpected and goes sprawling into a steel door, which makes a loud clanging noise. Naturally, this wakes up the sleeping teenage gangster, Maria's second cousin Marvin. Startled, he sits up, seeing Kieran stumbling to get up and Ava holding his relative's urn.
What the fuck? You're stealing my cousin Maria's urn? What kind of sick fucks are you?
It's not what you think.
Marvin gets to his feet, grabbing the gun lodged in the couch cushions and pointing it at them.
Yeah? What is it then?
We're sorry for breaking in and shit like that, but your cousin needs this more than you do.
What kind of bullshit you on?
Out of the corner of his eye, Kieran spots a wooden baseball bat lying upright in the corner near the door.
Sorry about this, kid, but it's nothing personal.
I don't give a fuck about your sorry. You're gonna
In an instant, Kieran reaches back, grabs the bat, and flings it toward young Marvin, striking him in the face, sending him reeling back to the couch.
Ah, you motherfuckers!
Kieran and Ava burst toward the door, running as fast as they can out of the house, Ava cradling the urn like a football. Exterior, Maria's house continuous. Kieran and Ava sprint out of the house, making a mad dash for the car. Ava opens the passenger side door and gets in, still clutching the urn, just as Kieran gets to the driver's side door and gets in. Kieran quickly tries to start the car when Ava sees Marvin kicking the front door open.
Shit, go, go, go!
Kieran looks to his left, seeing Marvin striding toward the car while raising his gun. In an instant, Kieran starts the car and takes off, just as Marvin fires his first shot and misses.
That's not how I envisioned this all going down.
Me neither.
Marvin stands in the middle of the street, firing shots at Kieran's car, missing wildly each time.
Good thing that kid can't shoot for shit.
Ava laughs, leaning back in the passenger seat, clutching the urn. Exterior cemetery minutes later. Ava watches as the now shirtless Kieran climbs out of the cemetery grave he just dug.
That should be good enough, yeah?
More than enough. Don't think it needed to be just 6 feet for an urn.
Look, after all that shit, not gonna take any chances.
Good point. So, should we say something?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you knew her, though, so...
Right. Well, may you finally find the home and the peace that you deserve.
An errant tear streams down Ava's face as she hands the urn to Kieran, who jumps into the grave, gently setting the urn in the middle of the plot. He climbs back up, grabbing the shovel.
Rest in peace, Maria.
Kieran digs the shovel into the pile of dirt, dropping it into the plot as he continues to fill up the grave. Exterior, underworld riverbanks. Ava and Kieran step out of Kieran's skiff, where they see Maria and Persephone approach them slowly. When she gets within an arm's reach of Kieran, she starts violently coughing, spitting out a large servile obol.
Oh my god.
Ava jumps and gives Kieran a hug. A flabbergasted Maria picks up the coin as a large crowd forms around them.
What does this mean?
Ava turns to Maria gently.
It means you can finally leave these banks. I'm sorry it took so long.
Ava motions toward the shore where Kieran's skiff is waiting. Ava, Persephone, and Kieran gently guide and overwhelm Maria towards the skiff. Kieran sticks out his hand sternly. Maria places the silver obol in his hand, which leads the crowd of unburied behind them to burst into applause. Tears stream down Maria's face as she looks at Ava and Persephone. Without saying anything, Maria gives Ava a big hug.
Thank you, Ava.
Ava gets teary-eyed too, hugging Maria tighter. While they embrace, Kieran leans over the skiff, getting close to Persephone's face.
Meet us on the LA side of the portal at midnight. I'll explain everything.
Persephone looks up at Kieran as he nods, while Ava helps Maria into the skiff. Kieran pushes off from the shore, steering the skiff down the river as Maria waves to everyone and the crowd bursts into applause again. Exterior, LA River, midnight. Kieran and Ava lean against Kieran's car near the Olympic Boulevard overpass, and after a few beats go by, the space under the overpass turns red and Persephone walks through as it closes behind her in an instant.
Okay, I'm here. What couldn't you tell me down there?
Okay, a few years before I left, I used to sneak up here after a shitty day, get drunk, sneak back, and no one was the wiser. The booze they have up here is so much better than that shit Hades has down there.
Charming, as usual.
Do I need to be here for this? Because it sounds more like a personal...
No, please stay. Anyway, just over 2 years ago, Hades came to me and he wanted me to help him assemble an army to take over Earth.
What? No, That can't be.
Like, I refused, and he threatened to kill me, so I fled to Earth. He never knew I came up here anyway, and I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want to endanger you.
He never knew about us. I swear.
I couldn't take the chance. But that's not all. The first night here on Earth, I got drunk.
Persephone rolls her eyes.
Oh, come on.
What, are you a Mormon?
Please, of all the things to be.
No, listen. I'm walking down this alley, and these bums are begging for change. And when I walked by one of them, he spit this out.
Karan pulls out a silver obol.
Oh, my God.
That came out of someone up here?
Not just that one.
Karan pulls a small Ziploc bag from his back pocket, which shows a dozen or so obols clanging together in the bag.
No. No.
Every time I saw someone spit one of these out, they had no idea who they were or why they were here. He's just wiping their minds, probably using them as spies up here.
And all those unburied on the banks?
His very own, most likely unwitting army.
What do you think this really means?
Hades is coming. For Earth. And we have to stop him.
Charon, Ava, and Persephone all try to comprehend this in silence. In the background, a homeless man shuffles into frame, causing Charon, Ava, and Persephone to turn and face him. He offers a polite wave and keeps shuffling across. Interior underworld throne room continuous. Hades and Hermes, with his winged hat, watch the live feed from this homeless man slash vessel slash spy on a holographic display as we see his hand wave past his eyes when he waved to Charon, to Charon, Ava, and Persephone. Almost made it. When he waved to Charon, Ava, and Persephone and started walking away.
What do you think, Hades?
I think we may have to alter our plans, Hermes.
Smash to black. End of pilot. Woo. Very, woo! Very interesting. Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
So, guys, we are going to interview Brian Gallagher, who wrote Charon, which we just wrote. To remind you, Brian Gallagher is a prolific entertainment journalist with many, many scripts. You've written 11 features, 3 half-hour pilots, 3 one-hour pilots, 2 specs. I would consider that very prolific, and it's an honor to have you, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I think I want to start. One of my favorite things about this script is all the little Easter eggs you put in here. Yeah. So I didn't catch it till this read, but Olympic Boulevard, Mount Olympus, it's pretty cool. Were there any others that, like, nerds of Greek mythology would be noticing?
Well, I mean, the stuff from the plucking the bow, that's actually from the Aeneid. That's, like, an actual story from the Aeneid. It was Sybil and was Aeneas, and he was looking for his father, needed to tell him something, and so that was the process that you had to go through when you're a living mortal and you need to see someone in the underworld. So
okay.
They had to go through this whole thing. They had to go through the forest, and it was a bit more drawn out in the book. But yeah, that was a real story from the end. And then the all the Cerberus stuff, like Hercules did try to steal Cerberus. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because of that, but it was a different reason. But yeah, there's a lot of different little Easter eggs just thrown around in there.
It's interesting because the Ava Clara stuff was very broad, like that was drawn as a very ugly sibling relationship.
Yeah.
But I wondered if that was a nod to classic Greek mythology because there's so many crazy sibling relationships in Mount Olympus.
Yeah, a bit. It was, I don't think there was anything, a specific one that it was based on, but yeah, I mean, there was definitely so many of those kind of, sibling clashes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't based on anything specific though.
So what's your relationship to Greek mythology? Right? I'm like, assuming you're a huge mythology nerd too.
I mean, the thing is, it always been in the back when I started like writing scripts, like the mythology thing would always, I was never like a scholar or anything, but I took a bunch of classes in college and, it was always in the back of my head to try to do something. These mythological characters in our world always fascinated me. And I was kind of worried when American Gods came out. And I'm like, well, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And so, but Charon always fascinated me, especially because there's nothing about him like in any of the books. Like, he's a character in all these books, but you don't know much about him. He's just this guy. That's his one job. And so it really kind of left a lot to play with, and there's a lot to do with this character that isn't on the books. He's there, and he's a god, and he's immortal, but beyond that, I mean, it's just kind of ripe to play with.
Super interesting, and you touch on it some in the pilot, but do you feel like you want to sort of lean into Charon's aimlessness? Like, he himself needs to discover who he is?
Yeah, I mean, that if anything happens with this and does go forward, then yeah, it'll be a lot of kind of him kind of finding himself,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, I mean, there was a couple different versions of the pilot where there was one where he gets people in his lift and It's not homeless. I kind of narrowed it into like homeless people that were these spies. Mm-hmm. But in earlier versions, it was like when he was just giving random people Lyft rides, and they would get in the car and they spit this coin out. And because I thought that was fascinating too, because I always assumed like, you know, Moondog Saints and all these movies, they talk about the two coins over the eye, and like that's not how it was. It was like they literally put this big. It was like a large, just about like kind of a half dollar size, mm-hmm. this big kind of ornate silver coin that they would put in your mouth when you're buried, and that somehow transferred over to the underworld, and that was his fare. And that's the thing too. Like that's not, there's no real like logistics towards that either. Like how the fare is paid and stuff like that. There's no real logistics about that. So that was just something I came up with too. It was like, okay, well if they're there and they're like dead and they have this thing and they come in contact with him, then they spit this coin out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Ava is such an interesting choice for our surrogate, like for us to enter this world. Can you talk about why developing that character and why making her sort of our everyman protagonist to take us through the story? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I always wanted to be in LA. The LA River thing was always kind of one of the drawing points too, just because like I said in the script, there's literally no water in the river.
Yeah.
And like it's just this concrete thing that goes through the city. And so like I always thought that was fascinating. And that was part of the reason why I did that scene when they drive through that, made that the portal. But
it's a little Back to the Future, which I love.
Yeah, for sure. So, but it was that. And then since I knew I wanted to set it here, I'm like, if I'm setting it in LA, I might as well make it like diverse, and mm-hmm. and instead of just having like a regular white dude. And like I always saw, like when I was writing this, I saw Stephen Lang as Karen. Mm. Like if anything happens with it, and then Ava, I don't know. I mean, it could be anyone, but it definitely needs to be a very strong Latina woman that plays Ava. But yeah, I always thought it'd be, and it was a challenge to me too, because I mean, as a 41-year-old white dude, like it's something I haven't really, a muscle I haven't flexed, like writing for like a diverse character like that. So it was definitely a challenge for me.
What work did you sort of do to prepare yourself to really dive into that role?
As far as like the mythology stuff, I never really do a lot of research when I write. It's usually just kind of online and stuff like that. But with this, I delve into a lot of mythology. I went back and reread the Aeneid, a lot of Ovid stuff, even though that's Roman. But just a lot of different, anything I find in Charon, anything I find about the underworld, and that's how I stumbled upon that the Bao story. And so that was just so fascinating that I had to put that in there. It's like, because everyone knows about the underworld, but there's no one really. No one really knows about like that particular story, mm-hmm. unless you're like a diehard like devotee. But so there was that, and then when I decided on Ava for the character, then I wanted her to be kind of have a checkered past, and so I looked into all the gang stuff and saw what the Cholas, like what kind of sets they would be in that area. So I looked into stuff like that a lot, and that's pretty much about it.
Mm-hmm. It's in LA that we're not seeing enough on TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why did you choose a Latina?
It was something that it was really more of a challenge for me, because I just to get me to write different characters and especially if it's setting here, there are more Latinas here than
mm-hmm.
So it just felt right, and
makes sense.
And it just felt right to have a character like that, and especially someone that we don't see that often. Mm-hmm. So
cool.
Yeah, the LA stories we see on TV almost always feature transplants, and you know they're like white girl Instagram models, so mm-hmm. it's nice.
Well,
for
that
us.
Was and that was why I chose the Lyft drivers at the beginning, the or the passengers at the beginning. The prototypical LA people, like getting dropped off at the Grove or at Paramount or whatever, like those are our typical, like the typical people you see in other stories that are just kind of our minor players here.
Yeah, like you're sort of slowly ushering us out of the LA we expect, and then giving us a new one, which I think is pretty smart.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about writing Charon? Because he's as a protagonist and as the main character and as the title of the script, he's very much like this. You know, like throughout the whole thing, and it's the characters around him that kind of put him in these situations that make him, it's almost like his calmness very interesting.
Yeah.
So can you talk about using his calm as being a driving point as his character?
Yeah. It was, I always wanted him to be, I mean, he's, like I said, there's the line that he's always portrayed as a greedy prick in the books. And so like, I wanted him to be there. I mean, he was there for a reason, to kind of, he's avoiding Hades, but I wanted him to be kind of, I wanted to seem more reflective about his, he's been here for 2 years, and in those 2 years he's been reflecting on who he is, and that moroseness kind of comes through, and like he's been reflecting on all the millions of years that he's been doing that job and being this greedy guy and knowing that all this stuff is happening on these banks, and he not that he can do anything about it, but he obviously doesn't really care. I mean, he didn't anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and that'll be another big through line if anything happens with this, and you'll see that arc a lot more, and you'll see, like, maybe not necessarily a path towards redemption, but just towards, like, maybe being the real him.
Yeah, well, you see, like, hints of warmth starting to show up, like, halfway through.
Yeah,
that's super interesting, too. It's almost like, do you feel like one of the through lines of the show will be, like, trying to create a more just way for the dead to be assessed? And, like, because it is, right now, it is kind of bullshit how it's handled, so.
Well, that was the thing, too. Like, there was a lot of different, before I landed on, like, all those, I always had them go into the underworld, but the unburied stuff, like that whole herd, like that was never really shown in, like, early drafts. So that was something that I'm like, I was just kind of doing, I kept going back to, like, more research while I was going through separate drafts. And so I'm like, well, they should all be there. And, like, that should be, like, a driving point of why they're there. And their whole little mission at the end, that was a lot different in early drafts too. So
did Charon and Persephone actually hook up in the books?
It was sort of like inferred, I think.
That was fun.
There was something there. It was actually a friend of mine from college. Like, he, when I was telling him about this script, he's like, oh yeah, you could have Charon banging Persephone. I'm like, oh man, I definitely got to put that in there.
Juicy.
Yeah.
Are you planning on exploring that love triangle?
Oh yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. What are some other, like, big plot points? Like, do you have a Bible?
I don't have a Bible. No. That's something I definitely have to start doing more, because I mainly, like you were mentioning the script out, but I mainly just write, and then I finish one. I'm like, okay, and I'll send it out for notes, and usually give it about a month or two before I go back to it. But I've been having some friends send me a bunch of Bibles, so that's the one thing that I definitely have to start doing more of and fleshing more out. Because I have another one. The other idea that I kind of pitched you when I sent you the email, like, that's a really crazy one.
Yeah.
That I really have to flesh out a lot more.
Yeah, the fact that this is the more standard of the two says a lot about your creativity as a writer, for sure.
The other ones, it's out there.
Are a lot of your scripts in the same tone?
Sort of. I mean, I had, like, the first few features that I did were kind of the start. There was kind of a satirical thematic trilogy, so to speak. It was like they all start with the same, like, kind of tagline at the top. It's like, this is not based on a true story, but it could be. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the first one is Disgruntled. It's about the government shutting down the United States Postal Service, like, completely shutting it down. And there's all these things put in place. But there's, like, one guy that it centers on. And he gets kind of almost killed by one of these new package guys. And so he goes on this crazy journey to D.C. to try to get his job back, like, beating up all these package people along the way. And then there's one called Janie Richmond, and there's one called Blackout Friday, which is a Black Friday satire thing. Yeah, it's crazy. So, but I've always had a kind of a satirical sort of thing to it, but, like, that was kind of my main thrust. And then as I started getting to more different kinds of scripts, like, that's always kind of stayed, but I'm still trying to branch out in more different genres. But I always try to keep that, like, satirical sort of thing.
Cool. Did you have a question, Tim?
I wanted to talk about Ava, because as a character arc, we're given a lot of information about her in this first episode. Yeah. And even maybe 70% of the script is just her and Charon just talking.
Yeah.
Were you worried that you were giving us too much information on Ava in the first episode?
A bit. There's a lot. I mean, I'm still working on other kind of threads if anything happens with it. But yeah, I wanted to make sure that she was someone that people could relate to, mm-hmm. and that people, and not necessarily people that have that kind of past, but I mean, people know that past, mm-hmm. and people know what kind of things she's going through. So, like, I wanted to make sure she's a really more developed character, more than Charon, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so much fun. One of the things I also really love, and I'm not sure if this appealed to you as a writer, but just, like, the set pieces.
Yeah.
Like, we have a lot of opportunity to explore the underworld, which is cool. Is that part of the reason that you feel like you
are? Yeah. I mean, I loved writing the stuff. Like, the underworld just kind of, I always had to picture it, like, just looking visually very different. That's why, like, everything's red and black. And so, like, it was something that I knew had to be very visually distinct when I was kind of crafting the underworld stuff. But, and there's, like, earlier versions I had Hermes had a bigger role in the there's stuff where, like, they're walking through the underworld and they feel a breeze and it's Hermes whipping by him because he's the fast, whatever. Yeah. So like there was that, and it just got kind of carried away. But like, so I, Hades and Hermes will definitely play, have a much, much bigger role. But like, for whatever reason, like they had bigger roles in earlier drafts, but I felt it best just to kind of tease them at the end, and then if anything happens, then they'll definitely have a bigger arc.
So you're kind of depicting Charon in a different light, like a kinder, more gentle light. Are you thinking about doing that with Hades as well?
Yeah, I mean, Hades is going to have a very different kind of arc too. I mean, he'll be the kind of the Thanos, I guess, of this world. Like, yeah, well, maybe not that, but I mean, but I mean, just like his philosophy, I guess. Like, yeah. he's trying to save Earth by doing
purging
this.
It.
Yeah. So it's in that same sort of vein. It'll be definitely a lot different, but it'll be when that story kind of fleshes out. Yeah, he'll be definitely in the same sort of vein as Thanos.
It is interesting because, like, this current iteration is sort of giving me, like, Stars or, like, Netflix, like, sort of a premium cable. But I do think there's, like, a CW version of this show that people are really excited about. I don't know.
It could work, yeah. It could work. I mean, I just for me, like, I always write everything as R-rated. Mm-hmm. Just always. Just because... I mean, I get notes on this. Like, oh, well, you shouldn't do. I'm like, well, if it gets picked up somewhere, I can change the words. I mean, right. That's not really a big deal. It's just something that I've always done. I've always written everything as R. And then if I need to change, I need to change it. But it's I have seen it as premium cable. Yeah, with the stuff that CW is doing now, yeah, I could definitely see it, especially with, like, you could be a good companion for like the 100.
Yeah,
and I saw it too. Like, and what's funny about the script is, like, it was not in development, but it was in consideration at Amazon Studios for almost over a year.
Yeah,
like it was strange. Like, it was, the first draft was in contention for like 6 months, and then they passed.
Amazon is so confusing because, like, they greenlit Woody Allen 2 seasons of his show, but like Amy Sherman-Palladino, who's obviously proven herself with Gilmore Girls and Bunheads and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel's one of the best shows of last year, they had to put that pilot up and let people vote for a year before they greenlit anything.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, that's when I submitted it. That's when they had that. They just ended that program like a few months ago, and so like basically what happened was I would put everything on there because it's free and it's like, who cares?
Right, exactly.
I never had any like huge expectations for it, but what happened was I put Charon on there and I put this feature script on there on the same day, and they passed on the feature 2 days later, and then Charon was in consideration for like 6 months.
Wow.
And then they passed, and then I already had a much better draft ready, and so right when they passed, I put the second draft on there, and that was in contention for like 9 months.
Wow.
Even passed, and then they announced that they're ending the whole thing, and that the whole site is like, you have your profile and you could have all your scripts on there, and all that I think was at the end of June, like, they just scrubbed the whole thing, and then it was. I never got an answer when they did that. They passed on it about a couple of weeks ago, but
yeah,
it's hard to say they're not doing it right though. Yeah. Whatever choices they're making, because like, gosh, they have more money than anybody.
Oh yeah. I mean, so they're that.
I don't know how their logic behind it all, but like, they're doing something.
Yeah,
right?
Because they. I liked what they were doing at first, because like, you would give, like what you're saying, like how they voted on the pilots, like. It gave viewers like kind of a say in everything, because like they would greenlight the pilots and they'd shoot all these pilots, and then they just vote all, they just put them up for vote for like a month, I think.
Yeah,
they just put everything up there, and then, you know, who knows how much the votes, you know, weighed on their decision, but I mean it was out there.
It's definitely a different TV landscape now than it was 10 years
well
ago.
And then now, I mean, now with Netflix, I mean, Netflix is spending like, I think, like $8 billion on content this year, and so they're trying to catch up. So that's why they got Lord of the Rings. That's why they got the Conan. That's why they got Starsky and Hutch. Even it's crazy.
Andrew usually asks this question, but
go ahead, shoot it.
One thing we like to ask is, I don't know if you've had this table read before, but in this context, hearing it out loud, anything that you really liked that surprised you? Anything you might consider changing in a future draft?
I liked how you read Ava. It was definitely how I pictured.
I don't know why she was from New York all of a sudden, but then I kind of just ran with that.
It worked.
But and then Persephone too. Like, Persephone came out. Persephone was definitely the sort of sly kind of devious person that I envisioned her. So yeah, that was definitely great. No, there's There's definitely things that I'll probably adjust, especially like action stuff wise, just tightening stuff up like that. But there was a lot of the stuff. I just finished a draft of this. I just finished about a couple weeks ago because I got some notes from a Latino writer who I was looking. I've had notes from a bunch of different people, but I'm like, I never had any notes from like Latina. So
was it a female Latina?
Yeah. Yeah, and she's this woman from Texas, and that I met from, she's acquaintances with other people on Twitter that I know. So, I reached out to her, and she gave me some really great notes, and then we tweaked the kind of the whole dynamic of how Ava and Charon meet is changed like a lot. Like the premise and the concept is still very much the same, but like it was a lot. It was kind of. It didn't really make sense. It's more organic this way. Like they like in the earlier drafts, like when he drops. Her off at Casey's after the Clara stuff, like he goes and has a drink with her, and like I'm like, it just didn't really. And then the fight, he's there when the fight happens, and then he bails her out of jail. Yeah, it just didn't really work. So we found a different kind of way around it, and it seems to work a lot more organically now.
Great. Well, it's such a fun script. Does anyone have anything else before we kind of make our way out? Mm-hmm. Well, Brian, we can't thank you enough for being here. You mentioned your Twitter presence. I know you're pretty active on Twitter.
Yes, so. It's at @GallagherMW, @GallagherMW.
Great. @GallagherMW, thank you so much. And if you guys want to connect with Brian, you can. And if you want to buy this thing, I'm sure you can reach him there. So
for sure.
One more time, guys. We read Charon, written by Brian Gallagher, and it was very enjoyable. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Nailed
thanks for
that time, Jeff.
Yeah, I know. I finally got it. I got through 100 Charons in the
literally every single one.
I said Charon.
That's fine. I called them the Bloodheads.
So. I was thinking in my head that he was like, I was like, he's joking. Charon.
Nope. That's just what I do. That being Jeff, guys, that is me. I host the show. If you want to find me online, you can do that at Jeffrey Seagram. You can pitch me a script there. More and more of you guys have been doing that. Thank you. If you like today's show, I think I would recommend Ramona. Do you guys remember that script?
Yeah, I love that script.
Love that script. That I feel like there's some sort of the same sort of dry, sarcastic tonal sensibilities between this and Ramona. That script follows a very likable and kind of sardonic woman in a wheelchair who's, you know, living her life. So it's really, really wonderful. Check that out. It's great. For the rest of you guys, where can they find you online?
Thanks for tuning in, guys. I am Timothy Michael. You can find me everywhere at I am Timothy Mike.
Hi, I'm Andrew Guy. You can find me online at that name.
I'm Roxy Stryer. Same thing.
Hi, I'm David Johnson. You can find me on Instagram at DavidRRJohnson89.
Hey guys, I'm Carolina Benetti. I'm Carolina Benetti on Twitter and LenaBean113 on Instagram.
And Carolina, thanks for joining. We had a great time. All right, guys, we'll see you next week here on the Unproduced Table Read. Thanks.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.